both of us hungover and thirsty, and the weak sunlight hit my scars and the words flickered to life again. Remission ended. My upper lip curled involuntarily in repulsion at the sight of my skin, and I wrapped a towel around me before I got back into bed. John drank a sip of water, cradled my head and poured some into my mouth, then gulped the remainder. His fingers tugged at the towel. I held tight to it, hard as a dish rag on my breasts, and shook my head. "What's this?" he whispered into my ear. "This is the unforgiving light of morning," I whispered back. "Time to drop the illusion."
"What illusion?"
"That anything can be okay," I said, and kissed his cheek. "Let's not do that yet," he said, and wrapped his arms around me. Those thin, hairless arms, a boy's arms. I told myself these things, but I felt safe and good, pretty and clean. I put my face to his neck and smelled him, liquor and sharp shaving lotion, the kind that squirts out ice blue. When I opened my eyes again, I saw the red twirling circles of a police siren outside the window. Bang, bang, bang. The door rattled as if it could have easily broken down.
"Camille Preaker? Chief Vickery. Open up if you're in there."
We grabbed our scattered clothes, John's eyes as startled as a bird's. The sounds of belt buckles and shirt rustles that would give us away outside. Frantic, guilty noises. I threw the sheets back on the bed, ran fingers through my hair, and as John placed himself in an awkwardly casual standing position behind me, fingers hooked through his belt loops, I opened the door. Richard. Well-pressed white shirt, crisply striped tie, a smile that dropped as soon as he saw John. Vickery beside him, rubbing his mustache as if there were a rash beneath it, eyes flitting from me to John before he turned and stared at Richard head-on. Richard said nothing, just glared at me, crossed his arms and inhaled deeply once. I'm sure the room smelled of sex.
"Well, looks like you're just fine," he said,
forced a smirk. I knew it was forced because the skin above his collar was as red as an angry cartoon character's.
"How are you, John? You good?"
"I'm fine, thanks," John said, and came to stand at my side.
"Miss Preaker, your mother called us a few hours ago when you failed to come home," mumbled Vickery. "Said you'd been a bit sick, taken a tumble, something like that. She was real worried, real worried. Plus, with all this ugliness going on, you can't be too careful. I suppose she'll be glad to hear you're here?"
The last part asked as a question I had no intention of answering. Richard, I owed an explanation. Vickery, no. "I can phone my mother myself, thanks. I appreciate you looking up on me." Richard looked at his feet, bit his lip, the only time I've ever seen him abashed. My belly turned, oily and fearful. He exhaled once, a long, hard gust, put his hand on his hips, stared at me, then at John. Kids caught misbehaving.
"Come on, John, we'll take you home," Richard said.
"Camille can take me, but thanks, Detective Willis."
"You of age, son?" Vickery asked.
"He's 18, Richard said.
"Well, fine, then. You two have a real nice day," Vickery said,
hissed a laugh in Richard's direction and muttered, "Already had a nice night," under his breath. "I'll phone you later, Richard," I said. He raised a hand, flicked it at me as he turned back to the car. John and I were mostly silent on the ride to his parents, where he was going to try to sleep in the basement rec room for a bit. He hummed a snatch of some old 50s bebop and tapped his fingernails on the door handle.
"How bad do you think that was?" he finally asked.
"For you, maybe not bad. Shows you're a good American boy with healthy interest in women and casual sex.
That wasn't casual. I don't feel casual about that at all. Do you?
No. That was the wrong word. That was just the opposite, I said. But I'm more than a decade older than you, and I'm covering the crime that... It's a conflict of interest. Better reporters have been fired for such a thing. I was aware of the morning sunlight on my face, the wrinkles at the edges of my eyes, the age that hung on me. John's face, despite a night of drinking and very little sleep, was like a petal.
Last night, you saved me. That saved me. If you hadn't stayed with me, I would have done something bad. I know it, Camille.
You made me feel very safe, too, I said, and meant it. But the words came out in the disingenuous sing-song of my mother. I dropped John off a block from his parents' house, his kiss landing on my jaw as I jerked away at the last second. No one can prove anything happened, I thought at that moment. Drove back to Main Street, parked in front of the police station. One streetlight still glowed. 5:47 a.m. No receptionist on call yet in the lobby, so I rang the night bell. The room deodorizer near my head hissed a lemon scent right on my shoulder. I hit the bell again, and Richard appeared behind the slit of glass and the heavy door leading to the offices. He stood staring at me a second, and I was waiting for him to turn his back to me again, almost willing him to, but then he opened the door and entered the lobby.
"Where do you want to begin, Camille?"
He sat on one of the overstuffed chairs and put his head in his hands, his tie drooping between his legs. "It wasn't like it looked, Richard," I said. "I know it sounds cliché, but it's true."
"Deny, deny, deny." "Camille, just 48 hours after you and I had sex, I find you in a motel room with the chief subject in my child murder investigation, even if it's not what it looks like. It's bad."
"He did not do it, Richard. I absolutely know he didn't do it."
"Really? Is that what y'all discuss when he had his dick in you?"
Good. Anger, I thought. This I can handle, better than head in the hands despair. "Nothing like that happened, Richard. I found him at Gila's, drunk, dead drunk, and I really thought he might harm himself. I took him to the motel because I wanted to stay with him and hear him out. I need him for my story. And you know what I learned? Your investigation has ruined this boy, Richard. And what's worse, I don't even think you really believe he did it." Only the last sentence was entirely true, and I didn't realize it until the words came out of me. Richard was a smart guy, a great cop, extremely ambitious, on his first major case with an entire outraged community bellowing for an arrest. And he didn't have a break yet. If he had more on John than a wish, he'd have arrested him days ago. "Camille, despite what you think, you don't know everything about this investigation."
"Richard, believe me, I've never thought that I did. I've never felt anything but the most useless outsider. You've managed to fuck me and still remain airtight. No leaks with you."
"Ah. So you're still pissed about that. I thought you were a big girl." Silence. A hiss of lemon. I could vaguely hear the big silver watch on Richard's wrist ticking. "Let me show you what a good sport I can be," I said. I was back on autopilot, just like the old days. Desperate to submit to him, make him feel better, make him like me again. For a few minutes last night, I'd felt so comforted, and Richard's appearing outside that motel door had smashed what was left of the lingering calm. I wanted it back. I lowered myself to my knees and began unzipping his pants. For a second, he put his hand on the back of my head. Then instead, he grabbed me roughly by the shoulder.
"Camille! Christ! What are you doing?"
He realized how hard his grip was and loosened it, pulled me to my feet. I just want to make things okay with us. I played with a button on his shirt and refused to meet his eyes.
That won't do it, Camille, he said.
He kissed me almost chastely on the lips.
You need to know that before we go any further. You just need to know that, period.
Then he asked me to leave. I chased sleep for a few darting hours in the back of my car, the equivalent of reading a sign between the cars of a passing train. Woke up sticky and peevish. Bought a toothbrush kit at the fast stop, along with the strongest-smelling lotion and hairspray I could find. I brushed my teeth in a gas station sink, then rubbed the lotion into my armpits and between my legs, sprayed my hair stiff. The resulting smell was sweat and sex under a billowing cloud of strawberry and aloe. I couldn't face my mother at the house, and crazily thought I'd do work instead. As if I were still gonna write that story. As if it weren't all about to go to hell. With Jerry Schilt's mention of Katie Lacey fresh in my mind, I decided to go back to her. She was a mother's aide at the grade school for both Natalie and Anne's classes. My own mother had been a mother's aide, a coveted, elite position in the school that only women who didn't work could do. Swoop into classrooms twice a week and help organize arts, crafts, music, and for girls on Thursdays, sewing. At least in my day, it had been sewing. By now, it was probably something more gender-neutral and modern. Computer usage or beginner's microwaving. Katie, like my mother, lived at the top of a big hill. The house's slender staircase cut into the grass and was bordered with sunflowers. A catalpa tree sat slim and elegant as a finger on the hilltop. The female matched to the burly shade oak on its right. It was barely 10, but Katie, slim and brown, was already sunning herself on the widow's walk, a box fan breezing her. Sun without the heat. Now if she could only figure out a tan without the cancer. Or at least the wrinkles. She saw me coming up the stairs, an irritating flicker against the deep green of her lawn, and shaded her eyes to make me out from 40 feet above.
"Who is that?"
she called out. Her hair, a natural weedy blonde in high school, was now a brassy platinum that sprung out of a ponytail atop her head.
"Hi, Katie. It's Camille."
"Camille! Oh my God, I'm coming down!"
It was a more generous greeting than I'd expected from Katie, who I hadn't heard from again after the night of Angie's pity party. Her grudges always came and went like breezes. She bounded to the door, those bright blue eyes glowing from her sun-tanned face. Her arms were brown and skinny as a child's, reminding me of the French cigarillos Alan had taken to smoking one winter. My mother had blocked him off into the basement, grandly calling it his smoking room. Alan soon dropped the cigarillos and took up port. Over her bikini, Katie had thrown a neon pink tank, the kind girls picked up in South Padre in the late 80s, souvenirs from wet T-shirt contests over spring break. She wrapped her cocoa-buttered arms around me and led me inside. No AC in this old house either, just like my mama's, she explained. Although they did have one room unit in the master bedroom. The kids, I guessed, could sweat it out. Not that they weren't catered to. The entire east wing seemed to be an indoor playground, complete with a yellow plastic house, a slide, a designer rocking horse. None of it looked remotely played with. Big colored letters lined one wall. Mackenzie, Emma. Photos of smiling blonde girls, pug-nosed and glassy-eyed, pretty mouth-breathers. Never a close-up of a face, but always framed in order to capture what they were wearing. Pink overalls with daisies, red dresses with polka-dot bloomers, Easter bonnets and Mary Janes. Cute kids. Really cute clothes. I just created a tagline for Wingap's Lil' Shoppers. Katie Lacey Brucker didn't seem to care why I was in her home this Friday morning. There was talk of a celebrity tell-all she was reading, and whether children's beauty pageants were forever stigmatized by JonBenet. Mackenzie is just dying to model. Well, she's as pretty as her mother, who can blame her? Why, Camille, that's sweet of you to say. I never felt like you thought I was pretty. Oh, of course, don't be silly. Would you like a drink? Absolutely. We don't keep liquor in the home. Of course, not what I meant at all. Sweet tea? Sweet tea is lovely. Impossible to get in Chicago. You really miss the little regional goodies. You should see how they do their ham up there. So great to be home. Katie came back with a crystal pitcher of sweet tea. Curious, since from the living room I saw her pull a big gallon jug out of the icebox. A hit of smugness, followed by a self-reminder that I wasn't being particularly frank either. In fact, I'd cloaked my own natural state with a thick scent of fake plant. Not just aloe and strawberry, but also the faint strain of lemon air freshener coming from my shoulder. This tea is wonderful, Katie. I swear I could drink sweet tea with every meal. How do they do their ham up there? She tucked her feet under her legs and leaned in. It reminded me of high school, that serious stare, as if she were trying to memorize the combination to a safe. I don't eat ham, hadn't since I was a kid and went to visit the family business. It wasn't even a slaughtering day, but the sight kept me up nights. Hundreds of those animals caged so tightly they couldn't even turn around. The sweet, throaty scent of blood and shit. A flash of Amma, staring intently at those cages. Not enough brown sugar. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, can I make you a sandwich or something? Got ham from your mama's place, beef from the Deacon's, chicken from Covey's, and turkey from Lane Cuisine. Katie was the type who'd bustle around all day, clean the kitchen tile with a toothbrush, pull the lint from the floorboards with a toothpick, before she spoke much about anything uncomfortable. Sober, at least. Still, I maneuvered her to talk of Anne and Natalie, guaranteed her anonymity, and started up my tape recorder. The girls were sweet and cute and darling, the obligatory cheery revisionism. Then, we did have an incident with Anne on sewing day. Sewing day still around. Kind of comforting, I suppose. She jabbed Natalie Keene in the cheek with her needle. I think she was aiming for the eye, you know, like Natalie did to that little girl back in Ohio. Philadelphia. One minute the two were sitting nice and quiet next to each other. They weren't friends, they were in different grades, but sewing's open. And Anne was humming something to herself and looking just like a little mother. And then it happened. How hurt was Natalie? Not too bad. Me and Ray White Scarver, she's the second grade teacher now. Used to be Ray Little, few years below us, and not little. At least not then, she's dropped a few pounds. Anyway, me and Ray pulled Anne off and Natalie had this needle sticking right out of her cheek just an inch below her eye. Didn't cry or nothing. Just wheezed in and out like an angry horse. An image of Anne with her crooked hair weaving the needle through cloth, remembering a story about Natalie and her scissors, a violence that made her so different. And before she thought it through, the needle into flesh, easier than you'd think, hitting bone in one quick thrust. Natalie with the metal spearing out of her like a tiny silver harpoon. Anne did it for no clear reason? One thing I learned about those two, they didn't need a reason to strike out. Did other girls pick on them? Were they under stress? Ha ha! It was a genuinely surprised laugh, but it came out in a perfect, unlikely ha ha. Like a cat looking at you and saying, meow. Well, I wouldn't say school days were something they look forward to, Katie said. But you should ask your little sister about that. I know you say Amma bullied them. God help us when she hits high school. I waited in silence for Katie Lacey Brucker to gear up and talk about my sister. Bad news, I guessed. No wonder she was so happy to see me. Remember how we ran Calhoun? What we thought was cool became cool. Who we didn't like, everyone hated. She sounded fairy tale dreamy, as if she were thinking of a land of ice cream and bunnies. I only nodded. I remember a particularly cruel gesture on my part. An over-earnest girl named Leanne, a leftover friend from grade school, had displayed too much concern about my mental state, suggested I might be depressed. I snubbed her pointedly one day when she came scurrying over to speak with me before school. I can still remember her. Books bundled under her arms, that awkward printed skirt, her head kept a bit low whenever she addressed me. I turned my back on her, blocked her from the group of girls I was with, made some joke about her conservative church clothes. The girls ran with it. For the rest of the week, she was pointedly taunted. She spent the last 2 years of high school hanging out with teachers during lunch. I could have stopped it with one word, but I didn't. I needed her to stay away. Your sister is like us times three, and she has a major mean streak. Mean streak how? Katie pulled a soft pack of cigarettes from the end table drawer, lit one with a long fireplace match. Still a secret smoker. Oh, she and those three girls, those little blonde things with the tits already, they rule the school, and Emma rules them. Seriously, it's bad. Sometimes funny, but mostly bad. They make this fat girl get them lunch every day, and before she leaves, they make her eat something without using her hands, just dig her face in there on the plate. She scrunched up her nose but didn't seem otherwise bothered. Another little girl they cornered and made her lift up her shirt and show the boys, because she was flat. They made her say dirty things while she was doing it. It is a rumor going around that they took one of their old friends, a girl named Ronna Deal they'd fallen out with, took her to a party, got her drunk, and kind of gave her as a present to some of the older boys. Stood guard outside the room till they were done with her. "They're barely 13," I said. I thought of what I'd done at that age. For the first time I realized how offensively young it was. "These are precocious little girls. We did some pretty wild things ourselves at not much older." Katie's voice got huskier with her smoke. She blew it up and watched it hover blue above us. "We never did anything that cruel. We came pretty damn close, Camille." "You did. I didn't." We stared at each other, privately cataloging our power plays. "Anyway, Emma fucked with Anne and Natalie a lot," Katie said. "It was nice your mom took so much interest in them." "My mom tutored Anne, I know." "Oh, she'd work with them during Mother's Aid, have them over to your house, feed them after school. Sometimes she'd even come by during recess, and you could see her outside the fence, watching them on the playground." A flash of my mother, fingers wrapped between the fence wire, hungrily looking in. A flash of my mother in white, glowing white, holding Natalie with one arm, and the finger up to her mouth to hush James Capisi. "Are we done?" Katie asked. "I'm sort of tired of talking about all this." She clicked the tape recorder off. "So, I heard about you and the cute cop." Katie smiled. A wisp of hair came unhooked from her ponytail, and I could remember her, head bent over her feet, painting her toenails, and asking about me and one of the basketball players she'd wanted for herself. I tried not to wince at the mention of Richard. "Oh, rumors, rumors," I smiled. "Single guy, single girl. My life isn't nearly that interesting." "John Keane might say different." She plucked another cigarette, lit it, inhaled and exhaled while fixing me with those china blue eyes. No smile this time. I knew this could go two ways. I could give her a few tidbits, make her happy. If the story had already reached Katie at 10, the rest of Wind Gap would hear by noon. Or I could deny, risk her anger, lose her cooperation. I already had the interview, and I certainly didn't care about staying in her good graces. Ah, more rumors. People need to get some better hobbies around here.
Really? Sounded pretty typical to me. You were always open to a good time.
I stood up, more than ready to leave. Katie followed me out, chewing the inside of her cheek. Thanks for your time, Katie. It was good seeing you.
You too, Camille. Enjoy the rest of your stay here.
I was out the door and on the steps when she called back to me.
Camille?
I turned around, saw Katie with her left leg bent inward like a little girl's, a gesture she had even in high school.
Friendly advice. Get home and wash yourself. You stink.
I did go home. My brain was stumbling from image to image of my mother, all ominous. Omen. The word beat again on my skin. Flash of thin, wild hair Joya with the long nails, peeling skin from my mother. Flash of my mother in her pills and potions, sawing through my hair. Flash of Marion, now bones in a coffin, a white satin ribbon wrapped around dried blonde curls, like some bouquet gone stale. My mother tending to those violent little girls, or trying to. Natalie and Anne weren't likely to suffer much of that. Adora hated little girls who didn't capitulate to her peculiar strain of mothering. Had she painted Natalie's fingernails before she strangled her? After? You're crazy to think what you're thinking. You're crazy to not think it.
Chapter 15. Three little pink bikes were lined up on the porch, bedecked with white wicker baskets, ribbons streaming off the handlebars. I peeked in one of the baskets and saw an oversized stick of lip gloss and a joint in a sandwich bag. I slipped in a side door and padded up the steps. The girls were in Emma's room giggling loudly, shrieking with delight. I opened the door without knocking. Rude. But I couldn't bear the idea of that secret shuffle, that rush to pose innocently for the grown-up. The three blondes were standing in a circle around Emma, short shorts and mini-skirts bearing their shaved stick legs. Emma was on the floor fiddling with her dollhouse, a tube of superglue beside her, her hair piled on top of her head and tied with a big blue ribbon. They shrieked again when I said hello, flashing outraged, exhilarated smiles like startled birds.
"Hey, Neil,"
blurted Emma, no longer bandaged, but looking tweaked and feverish.
"We're just playing dolls. Don't I have the most beautiful dollhouse?"
Her voice was syrupy, modeled after a child on a 1950s family show. Hard to reconcile this Emma with the one who gave me drugs just two nights before. My sister, who supposedly pimped out her friends to older boys for laughs.
"Yeah, Camille, don't you love Emma's dollhouse?"
echoed the brassy blonde in a husky voice. Jodes was the only one not looking at me. Instead, she was staring into the dollhouse as if she could will herself inside. "You feel better, Emma?"
"Oh, indeed I do, sister dear," she whinnied. "I hope you feel well also."
The girls giggled again like a shudder. I shut the door, annoyed with a game I didn't understand.
"Maybe you should take Jodes with you,"
one of them called from behind the closed door. Jodes wasn't long for the group. I ran a warm bath despite the heat. Even the porcelain of the tub was rosy, and sat in it, naked, chin on my knees as the water slowly snaked up around me. The room smelled of minty soap and the sweet spittoon scent of female sex. I was raw and thoroughly used, and it felt good. I closed my eyes, slumped down into the water, and let it flow into my ears. Alone. I wished I'd carved that into my skin, suddenly surprised that the word didn't grace my body. The bare circle of scalp Adora had left me pricked with goosebumps, as if volunteering for the assignment. My face cooled, too, and I opened my eyes to see my mother hovering over the oval of the tub rim, her long blonde hair encircling her face. I lurched up, covered my breasts, splashing some water on her pink gingham sundress.
"Sweetheart, where did you go? I was absolutely frantic. I'd have come looking for you myself, but Emma had a bad night."
"What was wrong with Emma?"
"Where were you last night? What was wrong with Emma, Mother?"
She reached for my face, and I flinched. She frowned and reached again, patted my cheek, smoothed my wet hair back. When she removed her hand, she looked stunned at the wetness, as if she'd ruined her skin.
"I had to take care of her," she said simply.
Goosebumps blossomed on my arms.
"You cold, honey? Your nipples are hard."
She had a glass of bluish milk in her hand, which she gave to me silently. Either the drink makes me sick, and I know I'm not insane, or it doesn't, and I know I'm a hateful creature. I drank the milk as my mother hummed and ran her tongue over her lower lip, a gesture so fervent it was nearly obscene.
"You were never such a good girl when you were little," she said. "You were always so willful. Maybe your spirit has gotten a bit more broken. In a good way. A necessary way."
She left, and I waited in the bathtub for an hour for something to happen. Stomach rumblings, dizziness, a fever. I sat as still as I do on an airplane when I worry one rash movement will send us into a tailspin. Nothing. Emma was in my bed when I opened the door.
"You are so gross," she said, arms lazily crossed over her. "I cannot believe you fucked a baby killer. You are just as nasty as she said."
"Don't listen to Mama, Emma. She's not a trustworthy person, and don't..." "What? Take anything from her? Say it if you think it, Camille."
"Don't turn on me, Emma. We hurt each other awfully quickly in this family." "Tell me about his dick, Camille. Was it nice?"
Her voice was the same cloying put-on she'd used with me earlier, but she wasn't detached. She squirmed under my sheets, her eyes a bit wild, face flushed.
"Emma, I don't want to talk about this with you." "You weren't too grown up a few nights ago, sister. Are we not friends anymore?"
"Emma, I've got to lie down now."
"Hard night, huh? Well, just wait. Everything's going to get worse."
She kissed me on the cheek and slid out of the bed, clattered down the hall in her big plastic sandals. 20 minutes later, the vomiting began, wrenching, sweaty upheavals in which I pictured my stomach contracting and bursting like a heart attack. I sat on the floor next to the toilet between hacking, propped against the wall in only an ill-fitting T-shirt. Outside, I could hear blue jays bickering. Inside, my mother called Gayla's name. An hour later, and I was still vomiting, off-green, nauseous bile that came out of me like syrup, slow and sinewy. I pulled on some clothes and brushed my teeth gingerly. Inserting too much of the toothbrush in my mouth made me start gagging again. Alan was sitting on the front porch reading a large, leather-bound book entitled only Horses. A bowl made of bumpy orange carnival glass perched on the armrest of his rocking chair, a lump of green pudding at its center. He was in a blue seersucker suit, a Panama hat atop his head. He was serene as a pond.
"Your mother know you're leaving?"
"I'll be back soon."
"You've done much better with her lately, Camille, and for that I thank you," She seems quite improved. Even her dealings with Emma are smoother.
He always seemed to pause before his own daughter's name, as if it had a slightly dirty connotation.
Good, Ellen. Good. I hope you're feeling better about yourself, too, Camille. That's an important thing, liking oneself. A good attitude infects just as easily as a bad one.
Enjoy the horses.
I always do.
The drive to Woodbury was punctuated with lurching twists into the curb, where I threw up more bile and a little blood. Three stops, one in which I vomited down the side of the car, unable to get the door open fast enough. I used my old warm cup of strawberry pop and vodka to wash it off. St. Joseph's Hospital in Woodbury was a huge cube of golden brick, cross-sectioned with amber-shaded windows. Marion had called it the Waffle. It was a mellow place for the most part. If you lived farther west, you went to Poplar Bluff for your health, farther north to Haight-High. You only went to Woodbury if you were trapped in the Missouri boot heel. A big woman, her bust comically round, was sending off do-not-disturb signals from behind the information desk. I stood and waited. She pretended to be intently reading. I stood closer. She trailed an index finger along each line of her magazine and continued to read. "Excuse me," I said, my tone a mix of petulance and patronizing that even I disliked. She had a mustache and yellowed fingertips from smoking, matching the brown canines that peeked out from beneath her upper lip. "The face you give the world tells the world how to treat you," my mother used to say whenever I resisted her grooming. This woman could not be treated well. "I need to track down some medical records."
"Put a request in with your doctor."
"My sister's."
"Have your sister put in a request with her doctor."
She flipped the page of her magazine. "My sister is dead." There were gentler ways of putting this, but I wanted the woman to snap too. Even still, her attention was grudging.
"Oh, sorry for your loss. She die here?"
I nodded. "Dead on arrival. She had a lot of emergency treatment here, and her doctor was based here."
"What was the date of death?"
May 1st, 1988.
"Jesus, that's a pace back. Hope you're a patient woman."
4 hours later, after two screaming matches with disinterested nurses, a desperate flirtation with a pale, fuzzy-faced administrator, and three trips to the bathroom to vomit, Marion's files were flopped on my lap. There was one for each year of her life, progressively thicker. Half the doctor's scratches I couldn't understand. Many involved tests ordered and completed, never to any use. Brain scans and heart scans, a procedure involving a camera threaded down Marion's throat to examine her stomach as it was filled with radiant dye. Heart apnea monitors. Possible diagnoses: diabetes, heart murmur, acid reflux, liver disease, pulmonary hypertension, depression, Crohn's disease, lupus. Then a feminine pink sheet of lined stationery, stapled to a report documenting Marion's week-long hospital stay for the stomach tests. Proper, rounded cursive, but angry. The pen had indented each word deeply into the paper. It read, "I am a nurse who has attended Marion Crellin for her tests this week, as well as several previous inpatient stays. I am of the very strong, underlined twice, opinion that this child is not sick at all. I believe were it not for her mother, she would be perfectly healthy. The child exhibits signs of illness after spending time alone with the mother, even on days when she has felt well up until maternal visits. Mother shows no interest in Marion when she is well, in fact, seems to punish her. Mother holds child only when she is sick or crying. I and several other nurses, who for political reasons choose not to sign their names to my statement, believe strongly the child, as well as their sister, should be removed from the home for further observation. Beverly Van Lum. Righteous indignation. We could have used more of that. I pictured Beverly Van Lum, busty and tight-lipped, hair gathered in a determined bun, scrawling out the letter in the next room after she was forced to leave limp Marion in my mother's arms, only a matter of time until Adora cried out for nursing attention. Within an hour, I had tracked the nurse down in the pediatric ward, which was actually just a big room holding four beds, only two of them in use. One little girl was reading placidly. The little boy next to her was sleeping upright, his neck held in a metal brace that seemed to screw right into his spine. Beverly Van Lum was not a bit like I pictured. Maybe late 50s, she was tiny, her silver hair cropped tight to her head. She wore flowered nursing pants and a bright blue jacket, a pen propped behind her ear. When I introduced myself, she seemed to immediately remember me, and appeared none too surprised I'd finally shown up. "It's so nice to meet you again after all these years, although I hate the circumstances," she said in a warm, deep voice. "Sometimes I daydream that Marion herself comes in here, all grown up, maybe with a baby or two. Daydreams can be dangerous." "I came because I read your note." She snorted, capped her pen. "Bully lot of good that did. If I hadn't been so young and nervous and awestruck by the great doctors around here, I would have done more than write a note. Of course, back in that time, accusing mothers of such a thing was almost unheard of. Nearly got me fired. You never really want to believe such a thing. Like something out of Brothers Grimm, MBP. MBP? Munchausen by proxy. The caregiver, usually the mother, almost always the mother, makes her child ill to get attention for herself. You got Munchausen, you make yourself sick to get attention. You got MBP, you make your child sick to show what a kind, doting mommy you are. Brothers Grimm, see what I mean? Like something a wicked fairy queen would do. I'm surprised you haven't heard of it. It sounds familiar, I said. It's becoming quite a well-known disease. Popular. People love new and creepy. I remember when anorexia hit in the 80s. The more TV movies on it, the more girls starve themselves. You always seemed okay, though. I'm glad. I'm okay, mostly. I have another sister, a girl born after Marion, I worry about. You should. Dealing with an MBP mom, it doesn't pay to be the favorite. You were lucky your mother didn't take more of an interest in you. A man in bright green scrubs zipped down the hallway in a wheelchair, followed by two fat, laughing guys, similarly outfitted. "Med students," Beverly said, rolled her eyes. "Did any doctors ever follow up on your report?" "I called it a report. They saw it as some childless, jealous nurse's pettiness. Like I said, different time. Nurses get a leetle more respect now, just a leetle. And to be fair, Camille, I didn't push it. I was just off a divorce. I needed to keep my job, and bottom line was, I wanted someone to tell me I was wrong. You need to believe you're wrong. When Marion died, I drank for 3 days. She was buried before I hinted around again, asked the head of pediatrics if he'd seen my note. I was told to take the week off. I was one of those hysterical women. My eyes were suddenly stinging and wet, and she took my hand. I'm sorry, Camille. God, I'm so angry. Tears spilled down my cheeks, and I rubbed them away with the back of my hand until Beverly gave me a tissue pack. That it ever happened. That it took this long for me to figure it out. Well, sweetheart, She's your mother.
I can't imagine what it must be like for you to come to grips with it. At least it looks like justice will be served now. How long has the detective been on the case?
Detective?
Willis, right? Good-looking kid. Sharp. He Xeroxed every single page in Marion's files. Quizzed me until my feelings hurt. Didn't tell me there was another little girl involved. He told me you were okay, though. I think he has a crush on you. He got all squirmy and bashful when he mentioned you.
I stopped crying, wadded up the tissues and tossed them in the trash next to the reading girl. She glanced into the basket curiously, as if the mail had just come in. I said my thanks to Beverly and made my way out, feeling wild and in need of blue sky. Beverly caught up to me at the elevator, took both my hands in hers.
Get your sister out of that home, Camille. She's not safe.
Between Woodbury and Wind Gap was a biker bar off Exit 5, a place that sold six-packs to go with no call for ID. I'd gone there a lot in high school. Next to the dartboard was a payphone. I grabbed a handful of quarters and phoned Curry. Eileen picked up as usual, that voice, soft and steady as a hill. I started sobbing before I got more than my name out.
Camille, sweetheart, what is it? Are you okay?
Oh, of course you're not okay. Oh, I'm so sorry. I told Frank to get you out of there after your last call. What is it? I kept sobbing, couldn't even think what to say. A dart hit the board with a solid thunk. You aren't hurting yourself again. Camille? Sweetheart, you're scaring me.
My mother,
I said, before collapsing again. I was heaving with sobs, purging from deep in my belly, nearly bent over.
Your mother? Is she all right?
No.
A long wail like a child. A hand over the phone in Eileen's urgent murmur of Frank's name. The words, something's happened, horrible. A silence of 2 seconds and the crash of glass. Curry got up from the table too quickly, his tumbler of whiskey wobbling to the floor. Just a guess.
Camille, talk to me. What's wrong?
Curry's voice was gruff and startling, like hands on both my arms giving me a shake.
I know who did it, Curry,
I hissed.
I know it.
Well, that's no reason to cry, cubby. The police made an arrest?
Not yet. I know who did it.
Thunk on the dartboard.
Who? Camille, talk to me.
I pressed the phone to my mouth and whispered.
My mother.
Who? Camille, you have to speak up. Are you at a bar?
My mother did it!
I yelped into the phone, the words coming out like a splatter. Silence for too long.
Camille, you are under a lot of stress, and I was very wrong to send you down there so soon after. Now, I want you to go to the nearest airport and fly back here. Don't get your clothes, just leave your car and come home here. We'll deal with all that stuff later. Charge the ticket. I'll pay you back when you get home. But you need to come home now.
Home. 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 Like he was trying to hypnotize me.
I'll never have a home.
I whimpered. Began sobbing again.
I have to go take care of this, Curry.
I hung up as he was ordering me not to. Richard I tracked down at Gritty's having a late supper. He was looking at clippings from a Philadelphia paper about Natalie's scissors attack. He nodded grudgingly at me as I sat down opposite him, looked down at his greasy cheese grits, then back up to study my swollen face.
You okay?
I think my mother killed Marion. And I think she killed Anne and Natalie. And I know you think that, too. I just got back from Woodbury, you fuck.
The sorrow had turned to outrage somewhere between exits 5 and 2.
I can't believe that all the while you were making time with me, you were just trying to get information about my mother. What kind of sick fuck are you?
I was shaking, the words stuttering out of my mouth. Richard took a 10 out of his wallet, tucked it under the plate, walked to my side at the table and took my arm.
Come with me outside, Camille. This isn't the place.
He walked me through the doors to the passenger side of the car, his arm still on mine, and put me inside. He drove us in silence up the bluff, his hand shooting up whenever I tried to say something. I finally turned away from him, aimed my body at the window, and watched the woods flash by in a blue-green rush. We parked in the same spot where we'd overlooked the river weeks before. It roiled down below us in the dark, the current catching the moonlight in patches, like watching a beetle hustle through fall leaves.
"Now my turn for the cliché," Richard said, his profile to me. "Yes, I was first interested in you because I was interested in your mother. But I genuinely fell for you. As much as you can fall for a person as closed off as you are. Of course, I understand why. At first I thought I'd formally question you, but I didn't know how close you and Adora were. I didn't want you to tip her off. And I wasn't sure, Camille. I wanted time to study her a bit more. It was only a hunch, purely a hunch. Gossip here and there about you, about Marion, about Emma and your mother. But it's true that women don't fit the profile for this kind of thing. Not serial child murder. Then I started to look at it differently.
How? My voice, dull as scrap metal.
It was that kid, James Capisi.
I kept coming back to him. That fairy tale wicked witch of a woman. Echoes of Beverly, Brothers Grimm.
I still don't think he actually saw your mother, but I think he remembered something, a feeling or subconscious fear that turned into that person. I started thinking, what kind of woman would kill little girls and steal their teeth? A woman who wanted ultimate control. A woman whose nurturing instinct had gone awry. Both Anne and Natalie had been tended to before they were killed. Both sets of parents noted uncharacteristic details. Natalie's fingernails were painted a bright pink. Anne's legs had been shaved. They both had lipstick applied at some point.
What about the teeth?
Isn't a smile a girl's best weapon? Richard said, finally turning to me. And in the case of the two girls, literally, a weapon. Your story about the biting really focused things for me. The killer was a woman who resented strength in females, who saw it as vulgar. She tried to mother the little girls, to dominate them, to turn them into her own vision. When they rejected that, struggled against that, the killer flew into an outrage. The girls had to die. Strangling is the very definition of dominance. Slow-motion murder. I closed my eyes one day in my office after writing down the profile. And I saw your mother's face. The sudden violence, her closeness with the dead girls. She has no alibi for either night. Beverly Van Lum's hunch about Marion adds to it. Although we'll still have to disinter Marion to see if we can get more solid evidence. Traces of poisoning or something.
Leave her be.
I can't, Camille. You know it's the right thing. We'll be very respectful of her.
He put his hand on my thigh. Not my hand or my shoulder, but my thigh. Was John ever really a suspect?
Hand removed. His name was always swirling around. Vickery was kind of obsessed. Figured Natalie was kind of violent. Maybe John was, too. Plus, he was from out of town, and you know how suspicious out-of-towners are.
Do you have any real proof, Richard, about my mother? Or is this all supposition?
Tomorrow we're getting the order to search the place. She'll have kept the teeth. I'm telling you this as a courtesy because I respect and trust you.
Right, I said, falling lit up on my left knee. I need to get Emma out of there.
Nothing will happen tonight. You need to go home and have a regular evening. Act as naturally as possible. I can get your statement tomorrow. It'll be a good help to the case.
She's been hurting me and Emma. Drugging us. Poisoning us. Something.
I felt nauseous again. Richard took his hand off my thigh. Camille, why didn't you say something before? We could have had you tested. That'd be a great thing for the case. God damn it!
Thanks for the concern, Richard.
Anyone ever tell you you're overly sensitive, Camille?
Not once.
Gayla was standing at the door, a watchful ghost at our house atop a hill. With a flicker, she was gone, and as I pulled up to the carriage porch, the light in the dining room switched on. Ham. I smelled it before I hit the door. Plus collard greens, corn. They all sat still as actors before a curtain. Scene. Supper time. My mother poised at the head of the table, Alan and Emma to each side. A place set for me at the opposite end. Gayla pulled the chair out for me, whispered back into the kitchen in her nurse's garb. I was sick of seeing nurses. Beneath the floorboards, the washing machine rumbled on as ever.
"Hello, darling. Nice day,"
my mother called too loudly.
"Sit down. We've been holding dinner for you. Thought we'd have dinner as a family since you'll be leaving soon."
"I will."
"They're set to arrest your little friend, dear. Don't tell me I'm better informed than the reporter."
She turned to Alan and Emma and smiled like a congenial hostess passing appetizers. She rang her little bell, and Gayla brought the ham in, gelatin wobbly, on a silver serving tray. A pineapple slice slid stickily down its side.
"You cut, Adora,"
Alan said to my mother's raised eyebrows. Wisps of blonde hair fluttered as she carved finger-thick slices, passed them around on our plates. I shook my head at Emma as she proffered me a serving, then sent it on to Alan.
"No ham," my mother muttered. "Still haven't grown out of that phase, Camille."
"The phase of not liking ham?" "No, I haven't."
"Do you think John will be executed?"
Emma asked me.
"Your John on death row?"
My mother had outfitted her in a white sundress with pink ribbons, braided her hair tightly on both sides. Her anger came off her like a stench.
"Missouri has the death penalty, and certainly these are the kind of murders that beg for the death penalty, if anything deserves that," I said. "Do we still have an electric chair?"
Emma asked.
"No," Alan said. "Now eat your meat." "Lethal injection," my mother murmured. "Like putting a cat to sleep."
I pictured my mother strapped to a gurney, exchanging pleasantries with the doctor before the needle plunged in. Suitable, her dying from a poisoned needle.
"Camille, if you could be any fairy tale person in the world, who would you be?"
Emma asked.
"Sleeping Beauty."
"To spend a life in dreams." That sounded too lovely.
"I'd be Persephone."
"I don't know who that is," I said. Gayla slapped some collards on my plate and fresh corn. I made myself eat, a kernel at a time, my gag reflex churning with each chew.
"She's the queen of the dead," Emma beamed. "She was so beautiful, Hades stole her and took her to the underworld to be his wife. But her mother was so fierce, she forced Hades to give Persephone back,
but only for 6 months each year. So she spends half her life with the dead and half with the living.
Emma.